This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by AlexRossArt.com. Alex has a brand new graphic novel coming out from Marvel and Abrams Books, Fantastic Four, Full Circle. It comes out September 6th. It's a rainy night in Manhattan, and not a creature is stirring except for the Thing, Ben Grimm. When an intruder suddenly appears inside the Baxter Building, the Fantastic Four find themselves surrounded by a swarm of invading parasites. These carrion creatures, composed of negative energy, come to Earth using a human host as a delivery system. But for what purpose? And who is behind this untimely invasion? The Fantastic Four have no choice but to journey to the Negative Zone, an alien universe comprised entirely of antimatter, risking not just their own lives, but the fate of the cosmos. Fantastic Four, Full Circle is the first long-form work written and illustrated by acclaimed artist Alex Ross, who revisits a classic Lee Kirby story from the 60s and introduces the storyline for a new generation of readers. Bold, vivid colors, his trademark visual storytelling, Ross takes Marvel's first team of superheroes to places only he can illustrate. The book also features a special poster jacket with the front flap unfolding to reveal an all-new, fully-painted origin story of the Fantastic Four. Again, Fantastic Four, Full Circle, out September 6th. For more details, go to AlexRossArt.com. Welcome back, everybody. Time again for Word Balloon, the comic book and pop culture conversation show. John Suntress here. I'm always happy to welcome back former editor-in-chief of Ring Magazine, Hall of Fame boxing writer, and novelist of, we're on his third book now, Nigel Collins. Good to see you, Nigel.
Yeah, it's good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, man. And I'm thrilled with this brand new book. It just came out on November 15th. And we're going to talk today about his new book, Hooking Off the Jab. But, I've been a fan of Boxing Babylon back in the day.
And that was a quarter of a century ago.
Wow.
And it's hard to believe, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. And my travels with Mary Jane, our last conversation, we spoke about your
You know, the one thing that I did, now that I don't work for ESPN anymore, I don't need a pseudonym for our thing. So, you know how on a book you list like other books by the author? I had Travels for Mary Jane right underneath Boxing Babylon. So I'm out of the closet on that because I don't work for ESPN anymore.
Well, is it legal in Pennsylvania? It's legal here in Illinois.
Yeah, I mean, it's legal in a lot of places. I think it's almost up to 20 states. It's not in Pennsylvania, but New Jersey, New York, you know, they're right around the corner. But the thing is, ESPN is so politically correct.
I understand.
It's sort of crazy. There's words you cannot use. But I had a great time there. I really did. I was there about 4 years, and I really enjoyed every moment of it. But, you know, when Manny Pacquiao got into politics, I wanted to write a story about it, and they wouldn't let me. They said, oh, no politics, no politics. I said, it's Filipino politics. It's got nothing to do. So that'll kind of show you, you know, that there are some restrictions there.
God, I have no idea how beyond what's happening on the field they might be covering the World Cup right now. Because
I like the World Cup. You know, I'm English, and I think they won their first game. But I do like to watch it. But it's on so many different stations and stuff. There's actually going to be a game in Philadelphia this time.
Oh, wow.
But I can't afford that kind of money.
I hear you, man. But I've been watching the FIFA documentary that's on Netflix currently.
The what?
There's a documentary about FIFA.
Oh, okay.
And frankly, about a lot of the corruption in FIFA.
It's just like the Olympics, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Corruption City.
Absolutely. You know, that's funny. When I was working at Sporting News Radio, Donna DeVerona she would do, you know, daily reports for us. And, man, she really taught me a lot about all the politics and, frankly, a lot of the double dealings going on in the Olympics.
It's really a shame because at one time, I don't know if they've always been crooked. Probably it just got worse. But especially boxing was big. They didn't wear headgear. And so you knew what the guys looked like. It doesn't seem like that's important, but it is, you know, and it's basically, you know, like fencing with gloves on now. They've taken all the violence out of it. And let's face it, that's what boxing's about, violence.
You're right about that. Plus, God, I mean, starting, I think after 88, starting in the 90s, just when NBC was, and I think they might still be televising the Olympics here in America, they just really screwed up the coverage. And yeah. It was hard to find. And
yeah, it was
also
late at night and stuff. Yeah. It's not what it used to be.
Absolutely not. Well, again, people need to read your book, Hooking Off the Jab, and we'll get a great account of, God, 40 years of sports writing for you, from Ring Magazine to ESPN to your current work at Ringside Seat.
Yeah, I've worked for darn near everybody in the long run. But it's been a long time, obviously, since Boxing Babylon. And I wrote that book. There was at one point I was the editor-in-chief in Manhattan, and we basically went bankrupt, and then Stanley Weston. So I foolishly turned down the job with Stanley Weston because it was so far away from home. It just wasn't Manhattan. It was Long Island. And my daughter was in high school. So anyway, I didn't have any work. So I wrote Boxing Babylon. Actually, it did very well. If this book does as well as Boxing Babylon, I'll be very happy.
Hear, hear. Well, we're rooting for you, Nige, because again, as always, great essays covering the current scene, but also taking account a lot of great history as well. And I'm excited to talk to you. You know, you're like you had told me in the email, you know, we'll talk about three articles and stuff, and we'll get into detail on that. But just in general, I do want to point out, you know, you have wonderful tributes to a lot of sad passings of, you know, people like Emmanuel Stewart, and
right.
Hagler. Hagler only last year.
Prince, Leon Spinks.
Yes.
Clinton Hayward. You know, the thing is, it was, you know, I actually covered my first fight for Ring Magazine at the end of 1972, but it didn't get in the magazine to 73. So I don't know whether I started in 72 or when my first byline came. And I don't have much of that material left.
Okay.
So the oldest story in the book is 1980.
Yeah.
And since 1980, there was a ton of stuff. And it was very difficult to pick out what I was going to use from thousands of stories. But what I tried to do is mix it up. So it wasn't all one subject. And as a vain person, which I guess most writers are, I tried to pick out ones that were the best written, you know. Some of the early ones are not quite as well written as the later ones, but the first one was about the Philadelphia Death Squad. And that was such a interesting story that I started out with that.
Yeah, honestly, that was one of the ones I wanted to talk about, because you talk about the difference between setups and fixed fights. And I think people do kind of assume that they're all the same thing. And I even remember in Rocky III, when Rocky is sitting with Mickey, and, you know, Mickey's like, hey, your last few opponents, they were handpicked. And, you know, yeah. And Rocky's like, setups? No, they weren't setups. But they weren't killers. But essentially, he was describing what you call setups, into where the dice is clearly loaded in one fighter's favor.
I think I mentioned in that story that all the great champions fought a lot of bums when they first started out. And that's, if you're doing it in fights where the other guy hasn't been told to lay down, that's what you do. It's an art to gradually increase the quality of the opponents. And if you do that right, when you start fighting the real tough guys, the top 10 or so, that's at your peak. The Death Squad was one guy by the name of Johnny Barr, who was he had a young son who was a good amateur, but he got a detached retina and it sort of ended his career. But he would take all over the East Coast. The northern part of it. It wasn't just in Philadelphia. And promoters would call them up and said, you know, I need this guy, and, you know, I want the ticket seller to win. And so what they were all guys who would fall down. They knew going into the fight they had to lose, and they did. And I think they got around $200. And they're just fixed fights. Setups are a little bit different. That's when you're not telling the opponent to fall down. You've just picked him because you think that's the guy who could give a decent fight but not win. And so that's legitimate in that, that nobody is like falling down on purpose because somebody told them to. So that is different. Now, the thing is, those fights, sometimes the guy who not supposed to win does, or he goes the distance and gives a good fight. But these Johnny Barr guys, I mean, I think if you read the story that I interviewed a couple of them, they wouldn't give their names or let me photograph them, but they were willing to tell me how it went. And one guy said, you know, I knew I could beat these guys. But after a while, I didn't try to go too long because I didn't want to get cut or something. So I just fell down. So, you know, it was... You know, next to, you know, making Jake LaMotta throw a fight, you know, which is probably the very top of that kind of stuff, these guys were the very bottom. And they weren't bad guys. They just were people that needed a few bucks in this, you know. But Johnny Barrs, he got out of the business. It wasn't just my story. There was newspaper stories about him as well. And actually... This is funny. I heard that he was threatening to, you know, beat me up or kill me or something. So I took a blackjack to every fight I attended for about 6 months.
Sure.
I never saw him. So I even had a plan on how I was going to attack. I wasn't going to try and hit him in the head. I was going to fall down and hit him in the knee with the blackjack. Thankfully, it never came to that. But it's funny, when people threaten your life, you kind of you think, well, what am I going to do? I don't have a gun. I don't want to kill anybody. But so that's what I did.
Wow. Yeah. I talked to Bud Schulberg years ago, and he was telling me that when he wrote The Harder They Fall and some articles Sports Illustrated, that he was kind of a marked man and had to watch himself and stuff. And that's,
there's a lot of bad people in boxing. You know?
100%, man. Yeah, absolutely.
Most of them are not the fighters.
100%, absolutely.
Well, we had a guy often, yeah, but they're not. You know, it's a really, it's just because you and I are addicted to it that we.
Yes. No, you're right. Well, again, when it's right, it's very dramatic, and that's why it's great to watch. It's funny. Our version of Barr, I won't mention his name. I don't know if he's still alive or not, but he, you know, he had his meat wagon of opponents. And one of his guys was a heavyweight, Andre Crowder.
I remember the name.
Okay. Well, you know, it was funny. He would usually, you know, get stopped early. But I remember seeing in the early 90s when Leon Spinks was still eking out a career.
Right.
I went to Gary, Indiana, and Andre Crowder went the full 10 rounds with Leon.
Yeah.
And really gave him a fight. And I think because he knew he was fighting a former champ.
And I maybe and, he and nobody told him to fall down as well. You know, maybe they figured he's going to get beat easy, but no. Yeah, there is another thing that if a guy is told, and I'm talking about somebody at a pretty high level. I'm not going to name their names because I don't have any proof. But basically what they do is if fighter A is supposed to be win and fighter B is just told – that he has to lose, not knocked out. So what fighter B will do, the opponent, will let the other guy win maybe 6 or 7 rounds. And down the stretch, he shows exactly what he could do. And that happens. It really does at a very high level. And, you know, if you see a guy losing the first 6 or 7 rounds and then just absolutely, you know, out fighting, out punching, everything short of knocking the guy out. So the guy won 7-3, you know, and did his job. But at that level, it's usually a threat, not money, you know?
Understood.
Yeah.
The, obviously what we experience now is the silos of each promoter not being willing to work with other promoters, and we're getting denied. I know we're getting denied some amazing fights. You've got a great profile of Terrence Crawford in your book. And of course, this year has been nothing but frustration while we've all been like anticipating the eventual fight with him and Errol Spence.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I don't even think about it anymore. It's just been going on. It was not quite on such a high level. It was like Mayweather and Pacquiao. They argued with each other. Manny didn't do much arguing. It was his fans, you know. But 5 years, everything changed. But I tell you something that's interesting. I just wrote a piece for Ringside Seat. That's going to be the next one. And it was about the rise of women boxers. And one of the keys was that the best are willing to fight the best.
Agreed.
And, you know, it's sort of shocking, but that's what's happening. It's because they're so hungry and because they've been, you know, minimized for most of the time of boxing. They're good.
They are good.
Yeah. I interviewed Bob Arum and he said for years he couldn't make any money off of women fighters. Even, you know, Ina St. John, who he got on the cover of Playboy, didn't make anything. You know, didn't make Bob any money. That's all he's interested in.
Whenever
you
interview
him, he keeps telling you, well, I'm a businessman, you know, not a boxing fan. And it's true. All promoters are salesmen. And he now has got two of the best in the world. And I said, well, you know, what's going on? I said, these women are different. They made it on their own. And they did. And, you know, so I've always... There's a lot of people that don't like women boxing. I mean, that's fading away. But for years, oh, I don't like to see women get punched in the face, blah, blah, blah. Well, if they're going to fight anyway, I felt they should get the equal coverage with the men. And about 6 or 7 months before I left the ring, I started the first and only women's boxing column because I just was – just felt bad. These women are training their ass off. They're getting beat up. They're sparring. You should like qualify who they are and what level you're on, of course, but give them the coverage they deserve. Because even when women's boxing was way back in the 80s, they'd always have a woman's fight on the card. Just one. It was sort of like a novelty.
Yes.
And they weren't very good, but they fought their butts off. I mean, it was often the best fight of the night. I mean, you know, women, once they decide to fight, they're going all the way. And so, you know, that actually was one of the building blocks to where we got today.
I hear you, man. You know, we had in the 90s here in Chicago, we had Chris Cruz. Was a solid female fighter, but there wasn't the competition to make good fights. I remember when Leila Ali fought Christy Martin.
Oh yeah, that was
it was Mutt and Jeff because really they shouldn't have been in the same weight class, and they weren't.
And also, Christy was past her best.
Yes,
and Ali was in her prime. You know, it wasn't what everybody thought it was going to be.
No,
but I kind of knew that she wasn't going to have a chance, but. She wanted the money, and she earned it by getting knocked out.
No, and I mean, my God, that documentary about her recently is just so tragic.
Oh, yeah,
we had no idea.
The fact that she at least got out of it eventually. I mean, that guy's still in jail. You know, I always thought it was a marriage of convenience. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Business kind of thing.
Sure.
But I didn't have any idea he was a monster. And she was always a very nice person, easy to work with. I think there in the book, I think so. In one of the interviews with Mike Tyson, I said, well, you know, when she fought on the undercard of your second fight with Bruno, she stole the show from you.
And I was there. Said,
yeah.
Yes.
And Mike, I was there too.
It's funny
we didn't run into each other. he said, I don't mind being second to her. She's really good. And she says, you can show her a move, and she learns it right away, you know. And it's a shame that when she was a little bit younger and a little bit fresher, because she had a lot of fights. But, Christy, I'm glad she is where she is now. You know what I mean? It must have been unbelievable torture.
Mentioning that fight, and I'll tell you why you didn't see me. I was up in the rafters with Phil Berger, who apparently had pissed off King, and they had him in the what they called the auxiliary press section. Literally, we were at the top of the arena.
Right.
And I'm like, why are you up here? I'm in radio. I know why I'm up here. Don doesn't give a shit about
radio. Yeah, I guess so.
And he's like, he goes, yeah, I pissed King off. The guy said, okay, well. And we had a lovely conversation. And no, we watched.
Yeah, Phil was a nice guy. He's sort of a tragic guy. He died very young.
Yeah, very sad.
He was a very good writer. Was he working for the New York Times at that point, was he?
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, I mean, he was.
Yeah. Why didn't you sit the New York Times up in the Z section? He must have been really mad. Because when Golden Boy bought the Rank, we always had a good relationship with Top Rank. And they punished me, which had nothing to do with it, really. They wouldn't let us have any of the photographs that their house photographer took, which they'd been doing for decades. But they also said at the same time, file you for your media credentials. We won't mess with those. So they were just punishing me a little bit, but still okay. Giving me a decent seat.
It's funny. Don Lenza wants to make a comment and says, you covered John. We were just talking about this off the air. John Collins versus Lenny LaPaglia here in Chicago for the Ring.
Is, yeah.
He's always been a fan of your writing. That's nice. He says he's putting me with you and says John and Nigel both covered fights in print. We were dying to hear about.
Yeah, we both covered the fight, and you know, it was the story was more about Chicago. Tell you the truth, like Ernie Terrell was promoting, and you know.
Oh yeah.
It was an interesting scene. It wasn't really, really, really big, but when you get the right fights, the fans came out.
Well, Collins LaPaglia was a good fight. By the time I honestly started covering briefly for Ring in around 89, but then really for Bert Sugar with Boxing Illustrated from 90 to about 96, even a little bit for Herb Goldman when he took over Boxing Illustrated after Bert stepped down.
He never did take over.
Well, the magazine.
He worked for both of them, but he was never the editor of either magazine.
Bert wasn't, or Herb wasn't?
Herb.
Oh, who was really running the magazine after Bert?
Well, what happened is when Bert got fired, I'd been working for him for about 6 or 8 months. And I was riding the gravy train along with Bert. You know, I mean, I go, hey, this is great. I didn't realize how much money they were losing. What happened is when Bert was fired, Randy Gordon became editor, but he didn't
last. This is Ring, yes.
He didn't last a year for one reason. He committed the worst crime in publishing, not getting the magazine to the printer on time. Because you can lose tens of thousands of dollars. It's like the worst. It's better to send a terrible magazine than no magazine.
I'm with you.
Because they're on the shelf 1 week less. And you've got to wait until there's a slot at the printer. So they cut the staff pretty drastically. And I became editor-in-chief. Last man standing, basically.
Wow. And how long were you editor-in-chief at Ring?
Well, my first started in the summer of 84. That was the first full-time job in Manhattan with Bert. And I think I stayed from my first issue with me, the editor, was 85. And we went to like 89. There was only 4 copies in 89. And wow. Then we stopped getting paid.
Wow.
So we all went home. So then during the time it was Stanley Weston had it out in Long Island. That didn't last as long as you would have thought. I think it was about 5 years. And then they sold it to the Karabatz family basically what they call Valley Forge. It's got about a lot of names, but it's really Ambler. and that was he had it for a long time until he sold it to Golden Boy.
Wow.
And Steve Farhood was the editor when I came back, and I was the managing editor, and then he decided just to go all TV. And so when he went to TV, and then it was November 2011 issue was my very last issue.
Wow. Okay.
You almost remember that, right? the day you got fired.
Well, yeah, Farhood was editor when I was submitting.
Yeah, Steve's a great guy. He's a great editor, he's a great writer, and he's a great guy, you know.
Well, the 90s in Chicago, you know, we had Andrew Galata, we had Craig Bojanowski in the cruiserweight division, but really beyond those guys, well, Louis Lamelli was a decent junior lightweight, and Angel Manfredi from Northwest Indiana certainly, you know, was doing pretty well and stuff. But otherwise, Don Lenza was certainly part of the scene. I would characterize it kind of as a tank town, frankly. I mean, it was a Cedric Kushner territory, but it was really there. I don't know. I mean, again, Ernie was promoting.
I think it was had passed the glory days. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And but like you say, if you get a good fighter in a good fight, the fans will come out. That's always the truth. Like television has a lot to do with it. I think ESPN broadcast from that hotel where Kushner worked, because I remember seeing Al Bernstein there when he first started out. You know,
well, anytime Bob would come through Arum on a press junket, he would always tell the story about how he had a Top Rank Boxing ESPN card. And Ernie had 10 fights, and Arum was like, 10 fights? And they were all like first and second knockouts. And they had to fill time for this two-hour block of TV with just them talking amongst themselves. And, yeah, he's like, I'll never forget it. It was terrible. You know. And it's like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, yeah, I've seen plenty of cards like that. So I understood. But, it was fun. I cut my teeth covering boxing for Burt Sugar and Boxing Illustrated, writing reports from these fights and stuff. And it was fun. And like I told you, when Leon Spinks fought Andre Crowder, that was a great knockdown, drag out fight that no one was expecting. And it went 10 rounds and it was all action.
I have a friend who's just become a boxing fan. And I had to explain something to him, that real boxing fans are willing to sit through umpteen bad fights waiting for the good one. I mean, that's what we do.
Yes.
We pay for the great fights by watching a bunch of mediocre or bad ones. And for somebody who's first coming to the sport, who is expecting good fights all the time, it's disappointing. But I think he's almost hooked.
Well, yeah, and it is. It's like a drug. I mean, honestly, I would imagine, you know, titling your book, Hooking Off the Jab. I mean, is there a bit? And again, also Tales with Mary Jane. A little, you know, you can't help but boxing is like a drug.
You know, hooking off the jab is actually a trick, right? It's a boxing trick. The guy thinks the jab's coming and you turn it into a hook. And I picked that because, well, there wasn't many. I spent a lot of time going through stuff and I rejected them all. Writing is a trick as well. And I think a lot of my stories aren't what most boxing people would expect. Some of the subjects, the way I write. So it's sort of, for me anyway, it worked that way. It talked about how there's tricks in boxing. And, you know, Jose Torres also used to talk about fear. You know, he got that from Customato, that you fear, you can actually change it to something positive, you know, and that's what a lot of them do. But, geez, when I'm scared, I'm scared.
But, yeah, it's the fighters that do turn that fear into a motivator and, you know, find another gear. We're talking around Tyson. Do you feel like now that we are, you know, 15 years past his last pro fight? I mean, I know he had the exhibition with Roy Jones, which, by the way, I found very entertaining.
It made Mike's him a lot of money.
Well, and I mean, Mike, you know, they were two-minute fight rounds. But I thought Mike actually, for a 55-year-old man,
what you know, I heard from good. People who watched it, because I don't pay pay-per-view for that kind of stuff.
Sure.
That after a while, Mike eased up on Roy.
He did. Yeah. He absolutely did. But now that we, you know, now there's a little more time, has the Tyson mystique diminished because of the second half of his career? I mean, has his place in heavyweight history slipped or remains? Well, I mean, depends, how do you see it?
It depends on who you are. If you're an objective observer, that's one thing. But his fans fell in love with him when he was knocking guys out every other week. And Bill Caton was a very smart guy. He would always have Mike come on, maybe the second fight, because he wanted to take the tapes and send it all over the country, should go be on the evening news. Bill Caton was not a very pleasant guy, but he was really smart. I got along with him well. But, so they fell in love with Mike. They fell in love with those tremendous knockouts that continued for some of his championship years.
Sure.
And that vision, they want to hang on to it. If you tell those people, well, you know, a lot of those guys weren't very good, they won't want to hear it. So there's a lot of people left over, people, you know, they're not really young now, that fell in love with Mike Tyson. I remember when he fought Lennox Lewis in Memphis. I went down for that one in Memphis. And by the way, I love Memphis. I don't know if you've ever been there. People thought Mike Tyson was the champion. Guys on the street. He hadn't been champion for years.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, and even after he retired, people thought he was still champion. So, you know, there is that lingering after effect. And I think anybody who fell in love with Mike Tyson during the early part of his career has stayed that way. And, I think, you know, as time goes on, people forget. But I don't think he's been forgotten. That's for sure.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. And again, you're right. There is that distance now from the general sports fan to boxing. And I think, sadly, don't sweat it, man.
Hold on.
No problem, man.
My phone was ringing. I couldn't turn it down enough. Okay, it's gone.
That's all right. No, and I honestly believe, I mean, it started with pay-per-view back in the early 90s, the TVKO cards and the Showtime pay-per-view cards and stuff. But it's only gotten worse now with streaming where, boxing has become an anonymous sport for a lot of general sports fans. And that's go ahead. Comment on that.
Showtime, you know, has had better fights since HBO, you know, stopped broadcasting.
Yes.
And but that's still a premium channel. You have to pay extra for it.
Yep.
I think, though, that ESPN is probably the only place you can see boxing on a regular basis on regular network TV. But they put a lot of them on ESPN Plus, which is streaming. Yes. And the truth is, John, streaming's the future.
Oh, it's the present and the future. No, you're right about that. But and for other sports, you're right. You're absolutely right.
The thing that bothers me is that I still subscribe to DAZN and ESPN Plus.
Me too. Yeah.
And but then there's all these other fights on other things. And you can't pay. How many subscriptions can you pay as well as your regular TV thing? So you're right. There's a lot of great fights that nobody sees. Except that, you know, the people that were willing to pay extra money. And, what are you going to do? But, ESPN and Showtime, you know, I think there's occasionally Fox. Fox has one.
Right. They're with Al Heyman. They're with PBC.
So is Showtime.
That's right, too. Yes, you're right.
And, I worked for Al Heyman for a year, maybe a little bit longer. And I never saw him. I mean,
I was going to ask. Okay.
I never met him. A couple of times, I remember one time I was sitting ringside waiting for the fights to start, and I knew he was right in back of me because I could hear him talking. And one time, a long time ago, I said hello to him in the tunnel where they come out of.
Sure.
And I did have one thing. He had a Russian cruiserweight or light heavyweight that we wanted to do a story on, and I got his phone number because he wasn't a big deal then. And I said, "We need some pictures." He said, "No problem." They were there the next week. So, but working for him, no, it was a lot of fun. I was traveling all over the country, all expenses paid. I really enjoyed it. But that was his first year. And that was it for me because he spent more than half that, he had $500 million from the hedge fund. And he spent more than half because they would take around on trucks that set they had. It was just he went overboard. Tell you the truth, he didn't need me. But I'm glad I got away with it for a year, you know, because it was a lot of fun. I saw a lot of fights. I went to a lot of places and, you know, but yeah, it's boxing is not making it easy for fans to see the fights. And of course, the British are absolutely crazy. My publisher gave me some very, very early returns on Amazon sales. And he said that it was 50-50. 50% of the people. There was a few in France, but mainly it was United States and Great Britain or UK. And
for your sales.
It was 50-50. So yeah. That we're a much larger country. But we've even said we've got so many requests for signed copies for England. I'm going to have a signing in a gym up in New York City on December the 1st, the Trinity Gym.
Great.
I haven't heard the actual time it's going to start, all the details, which I will later. But it's interesting to see that people in England are so boxing crazy. It's where it started. Modern boxing started in England for about 200 years. They had all the good fighters. And now if somebody can fight a little bit, they go bananas. And I think it would be great if it was like that here.
Oh my God. Yes. I know. Yeah. Isn't it? It's interesting because you're right. And certainly here, television kind of knocked out, all the great, you know, local stadiums, arenas, you know, the Blue Horizon by you. And, you know, we had Chicago Stadium and, you know, they're still in the back of my head. I really want to focus on those IBC years when Wirtz and Norris were the fronts, you know, the professional fronts for boxing and, just all the amazing stories of the gangsters that still had, contracts with fighters back then. And, you know, there was no choice. I mean, all the top contenders and champs were all managed by these, you know, crime people.
Now I think they just have a piece of some of them. I mean, they were never like, for years, they never presented themselves as the manager or whatever. It was just, they have a front man. And that's what that one story was about. You know, 10% off the top in the book.
Yes, which is another great story. That's honestly nice. This is why I really love the book. You really get into the business of boxing just as much as you do the great fighters and the great stories. I mean, wonderful. And we actually talked about it last year or earlier. You sent me your Dick Tiger tribute that you wrote, which I love. That's an amazing story. But no, it's stuff like the Death Squad and also 10% off the top and stuff. No, it's
that was something that I'd never thought about writing about it for some reason. Which just never crossed my mind. And it just suddenly came in my mind that I would do it. And Bill said, oh yeah, just do that. And it was one of the best stories, if I do say so myself, I've ever written. And it was one of the easiest because I was involved in all of it. I saw all of it. And boy, was it a trip, as you can tell, especially Alfonso Heyman. You know what's funny? I had five fighters. There was a sidebars about the other fighters in ringside seat. But in the book, the publisher said, you just can't have one sidebar on one story. So we cut that, the other three fighters out. But all of them. I know a couple of them still. Even Alfonso Heyman, I still have some sort of warm feelings about those guys, as if they're my children, you know what I mean? And I was about their age at the time. But you would think that some of the stuff that, you know, Jerome Artis and Alfonso Heyman did would make me, you know, even threaten to kill me as far as Alfonso was concerned. I'm not bitter. I'm just so happy that I experienced that, you know, because it taught me a lot about boxing, you know, how it really works. I all had an idea, but I wasn't part of it. And to be part of it, I knew after a while that it wasn't for me, but I kept going. And Actually, Bill says that's a story I was born to write. I don't know if it's that good, but yeah, a lot of people, I would say most of the people that are in boxing now have no idea I manage fighters.
Wow.
But I did.
Well, again, this is why I think the book is really so unique and worth picking up. And again, it's been out since November 15th, only a few days, but it's good to hear that you're going to do this signing at the Trinity Gym in New York. I think that's wonderful. And it doesn't surprise me that the book's doing well in England. I mean, God, they were not only Boxing Monthly, which we would get over here.
Well, the Boxing News is weekly. I still work for them.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. And isn't that amazing?
They're the oldest magazine still published, not just sports magazine. It was like 1906 or something, 1903.
Wow.
And I don't think they even stopped doing it during the war, World War II.
Wow.
Because paper was really hard to get at that time.
Sure. Good point.
But I don't think they did because I've read some historical things about them. But it's a great magazine that has always had good editors. They've got some courage. they printed stuff, like I told you about the Manny Pacquiao political story. When ESPN wouldn't let me do it, they took it. Nobody would touch the story about, you know, how cannabis shouldn't be on the banned list.
Another great chapter. Yes.
Boxing News took it.
That's so great.
Yeah. They have a lot of guts and they're very, very prestigious as people who follow boxing, you know, and they're like most everybody, digital and print. You know, when I write a story about a boxer, they always want to see the story, right? So there's no way you can separate a story from a digital thing and give it to a fighter. So I actually buy back issues to give to the fighters, but it takes a long time. It takes a long time.
Wow, that's really nice that you do that. I think that's great.
I love boxers, you know.
Well, yeah, no, and
some more than others, but they're special people.
They are. Agreed.
And I think I've talked before about my theory of that most of them come to boxing emotionally wounded. You look at the life stories of most of the boxers, they've had some really bad things happen to them before they started to be a boxer.
Sadly true.
Absolutely. So that's another thing. I give them a break, you know, now and then when they do something stupid, because, you know, a lot of bad things happen to them.
Yeah. And it's a tough life. And really, I mean, you know, they see the Ray Leonards and the Tysons and the success stories. But the reality is the Hammond Eggers and stuff that are willing to take $200 to take a punch in the face and stuff. That's, you know, that's the real. That's the big
thing on it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Marvin Hagler is a perfect example of a guy who came up all the way to the top. And it took a long time, but he was a special fighter. Yes. You know, there's not everybody. There's no Marvin Hagler's. There's not been one since. I think that Bernard Hopkins is the best middleweight since Hagler. And it would be very interesting to see them fight in their prime. But yeah, I mean, it's sometimes they do reach the top, and that's who all the other boxers are trying to get there, you know. But, hey, it is what it is. I don't like to say that, but it's true about boxing. And I've never got so disgusted that I wanted to quit. But, you know, I guess now it's one of the few ways I can earn a dollar, you know, because I've been doing it so long.
How many articles do you think you churn out a year?
I don't know. Probably less now than it has been in a long time. I mean, when I was at the ring, we were also doing KO, World Boxing.
Yes, I bought them all. I bought them all, Nigel.
Yeah, so the thing was that I realized, not the first time I was editor, because we just doing one magazine.
Right, yeah.
It hindered me to write because there was so much else to do.
Sure.
Now, if they sent me somewhere to Vegas or California or wherever to cover a fight, I had to cover it. You know what I mean? or they wouldn't pay me to go out there. But a lot of the times I didn't write as much as I would have liked because I had so many other jobs and we had such a small staff, you know, it was ridiculous. But I don't know how many. I guess when I was working for ESPN, I was pretty regular, but a column probably about once a week, something like that. Maybe two a month, whatever they wanted. But it wasn't that long, you know. It's hard to say. And it's really hard to say even who I wrote the most for, you know. But it was probably Ring, you know, even with me. A lot of the stuff that didn't carry a byline in the Ring I wrote.
Okay.
You know, the nuts and bolts stuff, you know.
Sure.
But I didn't sign my name to it because if you have everybody writing the same story, it don't look good for the magazine. You know, everybody. So and we had what I really liked about the last time at the Ring was how I helped a lot of other writers develop. I gave them their voice, and I was pretty hardcore there as far as you got to be damn good or you couldn't work for me. But when somebody had, I could tell they had some talent, I would just give them work. And that's how they got a voice, and that's how they learned to write better.
That's true.
A lot of them have said that to me. Bill, of course, Eric Raskin, Don Stradley. I was proud that I was able to help them. I didn't get paid for that part, but, you know, Bert helped me. You know, it's like, why not, you know? You got to give back a little bit, and that was a good. And photographers were the same thing. You know, if we wasn't good, I wasn't going to buy it, and we weren't paying much to start with. But I don't know. It's got to be thousands altogether. I mean, that's from great. 1973 till now, it's got to be thousands.
That's fantastic, man. What about venues that you covered internationally? Like, what were the weird venues that you?
Okay, I have covered a few fights. I covered a fight in Jamaica. Simon Brown, when he was the champ, his first defense there against Jorge Vaca.
Okay.
And that was great because I got a call from the promoter, Lucian Chen, at the office. I'd never even heard of him. And he said, we want you to come down to this fight we're having with Simon Brown. And Simon Brown's manager at the time was Don Elbaum.
Sure.
So I said, well, listen, I said, I've got a daughter who's about, I think she was about 8 or 9 at the time. I said, I can't really go away for it. He said, wait a minute, I'll call you back tomorrow. He called me back tomorrow and he said, we've got 2 plane tickets. You can bring your daughter. So I took my daughter to the place. And, you know, it was spectacular because everything was free and top drawer. And that was in the National Stadium, where Bob Marley had his funeral service and had that famous concert where he tried to bring the political parties together. And that's where Fraser got beat up by George Foreman.
Sure.
So, it was a huge stadium. But the problem with that is that most of the people in Jamaica can't even afford the cheapest ticket. When we came out, when the fight was over, me and my daughter got in the same car as Simon Brown, his wife, and their baby. And when we came out of, like, you know, the chute that goes down underneath the building, out in the street, there were hundreds of people. They had waited out there, you know, hearing like what's happening, you know, and a lot of them were kids. And that was the only way they could share in their hero's victory. And as we pulled away, they were all chasing down the road after the cars, almost all the way back to the hotel.
Wow.
And so the fact the crowd was not very big, I think, you know, that was the reason. They didn't have the money.
Crazy.
So, yeah, that was great. Another place I went, actually, I went to a stadium in Germany for a Klitschko fight, Vladimir Klitschko fight, basically because the Ring Heavyweight Championship was vacant.
Okay.
And number 2 was his brother, and they were never going to fight.
Right.
So
right.
I forget the hell's the guy's name he fought, but he won. And I had just gone over to give him the belt in the ring. So that was great. I have a friend who lives in Germany, an American. He was like my chauffeur. We did a lot of extracurricular activities, and it was good. And it was a huge crowd. I mean, it was over 60,000 people in there. And they thought it was the greatest fight in the world. It was the most boring fight in the world. But Germans are different, you know. And they had this special section on the floor where you would get all this free gourmet food. It was amazing. You know, the production values were great. The fight sucked. I went to Manchester to see Cal Zeghi fight.
Wow, great.
That was another belt job. I think it was when he beat Hopkins for the light heavyweight title, but it might have been the title he had before. And Joe Cal Zeghi was really good.
Amazing fighter, yeah. Yes.
And the why he beat Hopkins is Hopkins couldn't keep up with this, you know, the amount of punches he threw. He exhausted himself.
Pressure fighter.
And that was at the Manchester Arena. And Saki Obika, that's who he fought. And he butted him, and it was, you know, Saki Obika, he was a rough fighter, went the distance. But it was good. I got to spend a little bit of time with him and his dad. You know, his dad was a real character.
Okay.
And it was right after the press conference where I gave him the belt. We went up to their hotel room. And it was really funny. They had the case open and the belt on there. And every now and then, we were there maybe half hour, 45 minutes, he'd go over and touch it just with his finger, like he couldn't believe he had it or something. So that was interesting. I went in, the preliminaries were just starting. And I said to the guy who was sitting next to me, I said, "Where is everybody?" He said, "Oh, they're all out drinking." And it was true. A lot more people came in for the main event. So where we were staying was a short taxi cab ride. You didn't want to walk it. I have never seen anything like it. There were so many drunken people in the streets. They were like, this one guy was doing somersaults across the road, and the cab driver had to duck him. There were people laying in the gutter. There were people drinking. It was unbelievable. Because what happened in England was that the, the licensing hours were always 10 o'clock forever. And there was a lot of binge drinking.
Okay.
So somebody thought it was a good idea to extend it to 11 and they wouldn't binge drink. Bullshit. They binge drink for another hour. And in Manchester, boy, did they do it up. You know, there were women like collapsed in doorways and it was unreal. So that was Manchester. That was another one. I'm trying to think. Oh, I went to Canada, to Montreal, which is maybe, the center.
Sure.
That was good because there's a lot of good fans in Montreal. There might be some other ones, but I just can't remember.
No, those are great examples. Absolutely, man. That's amazing. I'm glad you mentioned Germany because I really think second only to the United Kingdom, really, Germany is a hugely popular boxing.
It is, but my friend who lives there, he's an American. He used to live in Tucson. Him and his job got jobs overseas. He said it's really fallen off since the Klitschko's retired.
Oh, wow.
And I was asking him questions for the story I did about women's boxing. And, they had two that were really big. That would fill arenas and have, were on TV. But the Klitschko's was like, I think sort of an aberration. They weren't even German.
Right. They're Ukrainians. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. They were Ukrainians. And that was, they sold out every arena they fought by the time they got to the title level. And I think if the Germans get another good fighter, they'll come back again. But right now it's pretty slow. My friend says it's coming back a little bit. I tell you something interesting. During the pandemic, he went to a fight in Germany where you sat outside in your car. They made a circle all around the ring with cars.
Sure.
And they had the fights.
Wow.
I don't know if anybody else did that, but they did it in Germany. I think it was just a one-off. But that's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. My God, yeah. A drive-in boxing match. That's kind of interesting.
I think, you know, you got to rank the fans, which is sort of stupid. But I think the Mexicans and the English are number one.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have boxing in the United States anymore if it wasn't for the Latino and Hispanic audience.
Indeed. Yes.
And Bob Arum was the first to realize that. He was the first to start to put on specifically for Latino and Hispanic audiences. And if they got a Puerto Rican against the Mexicans, you know, they had everything. So,
yes.
He, you know, Bob's a cranky, grouchy old guy, but I think he's the best promoter we've had in my lifetime.
I hear you, man. I agree with you. Absolutely.
I never told him that. But
well, don't let him hear you say that, maybe. But
yeah. No, I mean,
but no, it's you're right.
Because, but what is he, like 90-something now?
Yes.
And he's still running the show.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, his son-in-law does a lot of work.
Yes.
But he, you know, he's at all the press conferences. He does all the interviews. You know, so, you know, he's have you seen that video? Where I forget what the guy's name was, is sort of a bothersome writer. And he was trying to ask something or giving Bob a hard time as Bob and Frank Warren were walking out.
Was it Mike Coppinger? Was it Mike Coppinger?
Yeah, that's what it was. Did you see that?
I did. Bob, go on, explain. Go ahead, describe it.
Shut the fuck up, you punk. And like, Frank Warren's looking like he was flabbergasted. But that's Bob. You don't want to mess with Bob.
No disrespect to Coppinger, but Bob has seen every great writer for six decades. So
yeah.
I get it. I mean, literally going back to the 60s when he first started, sure. You know, working with Ali and everything.
Yeah, it started at the top. But yeah, I think, you know, he's hung on all these years. I mean, Don King still promotes a fight occasionally, but that's nothing. It's nothing to what he used to be.
Oh, no.
Main events really, you know, is faded, I think.
Yeah, they're hanging on, but not really.
Yeah, not much at all, you know. So, you know, so it's changed. People come and go. But except Bob Arum, he's going to live forever, I think.
I hear you, and you're right. I think, again, and his son-in-law is certainly well-positioned that when Bob decides to relax a little bit. But, I mean, no, you see him in these interviews.
He'll relax when he drops dead, I think.
Oh, probably. I was going to say, he's still razor sharp. I mean, he really is. I mean,
I interviewed him last week or the week before, and he sounded just the same as always. You know,
I remember he used to call John Saraceno in the early 90s. Here he comes, Bram Stoker's Dracula. making fun of Saraceno's beard and long hair and everything. So, yeah. So, no,
I was a good looking guy when he was young.
Saraceno?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, Bob. Johnny's a good man. Yeah, clearly not Bob. Absolutely. No. Bob kind of looked like the film director, Sidney Pollack.
I don't know what he looks like. I'm familiar with his work. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, if he's in Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman, he plays Dustin Hoffman's agent in Tootsie, Sidney Pollack. But yeah. You know, another thing that I love, and really, I don't want to keep you much longer. You've been sweet with your time, but
yeah, let's hype the book.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Let's remind everybody once again, Hooking Off the Jab, available now. You can buy it at Amazon. Well,
some of the other stories that you particularly interested
in? Yeah. Well, I want to, you know, certainly. Here, I'm looking through my list right now. Well, you mentioned that Mexico is such a great, you know, hotbed still for boxing. Yeah. I loved how you framed the Chavez.
Started with Kid Azteca.
Yes, and that's what I was going to say. Going into the history of a fighter that I had only known by name, had no idea the length of his career.
And I had no idea, Mr. Light. I mean, I knew who he was, right? I think we even put it in a magazine, but the details that I discovered, how those, it was the sailors and fishermen that used to wrap napkins and fight for beer money or drink money. And that's why they had the first boxing commission there. It's weird. You know, that's how the boxing commission started, because there were all these, like, you know, free for alls in bars, and they wanted to have some sort of control and safety. But yeah, Kiz Azteca, I thought what was really cool for him, he was almost washed up when TV became prevalent. And he was such a hero, he could fight anybody and everybody would watch. And what he had the welterweight title
of Mexico
for 16 years. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the stadium, Azteca Stadium, is named after him or the Aztecs. I'm not really sure. But he was huge. And TV really gave him like maybe another 10 years where he wouldn't have been without TV.
That, and also I loved your Carmen Basilio tribute. And man, I haven't looked since reading it, but thank God for YouTube, because so many great 50s and 60s fights and even 40s and 30s fights you could find on YouTube. But I would love to see Basilio fight Art Aragon if anybody was running film
on that. It was like a surprise. Like I told you, I was up there for a Hall of Fame thing, and the guy called me up and said, "You want to have lunch with Carmen Basilio?" I said, "Sure." So it was about, half a dozen of us went over in a van. And the way I write in the story is the way it was. He acted like he was our old friend, which he was. But he, say there were 10 people there with him and his wife and the people that came. He went up to everybody individually and had a one-on-one conversation. Did I tell you about the pickpocket thing? Oh, it's in the story. Yes.
In the book. Yeah.
Yeah. What he does is, I don't know how he does it. He comes up to you after he's taken it, and it's full time. He says, "Does this look familiar to you?" And his running buddy for years was Willie Pep.
That's amazing. Oh, my God.
I understand that Willie Pep was a good pickpocket, too. And there's a photograph at the Hall of Fame. And you know how there's a row of chairs where people sit on the stage until it's their turn? I think it was our Alexis Arguello or somebody's at the microphone, right? And Willie Pep's in front of him, and he's reaching over and stealing his wallet. Yeah, those guys, they were priceless. I mean, that was a treat. I mean, I never thought I'd have lunch with Carmen Basilio. His wife made the lunch, and he drank most of the wine. Well, we all did. I mean, they had those big gallon jugs of Italian wine, like
three,
and more food you could eat in a week. His wife was really nice. I mean, everybody dies, but that lunch made it a little bit sadder than it normally would have been for me.
I understand, man. No, Archie Moore and Gene Fulmer were my two golden oldies that I had the pleasure of meeting before they passed. Yeah. I missed, it was before I really got into boxing locally, but Tony Zale was, even past his career, was still a very important part of the amateur scene here in Chicago. And I miss Tony Zale, and it bums me out because I would have loved to have met and talked to him.
Yeah, well, you know what's really bummer? How they stole his belt from the Hall of Fame. I think it was, I think it might have been Basilio, the other one, but I know it was Tony Zale because his daughter often comes on Twitter and talks about it.
Wow.
I think I know who did it, but I'm not going to tell you on air.
I understand.
And that person didn't go do it himself. He hired somebody because nobody tried to pawn it. and the real value is in what they did to earn it,
Agreed.
Metal or whatever it's made out of, So that's terrible for the family,
Oh, absolutely.
To lose something. I mean, that's their main claim to fame for the family.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And rightfully so. I mean, Tony Zale was a hell of a fighter.
The Man of Steel. Absolutely, man. In more ways than one. Not only from Steeltown, Gary, Indiana, but tough as nails. No, an amazing fighter. Let me ask you really fast about a current fighter that I adore. And this is one of the few things I do like about streaming. And also the novelty of waking up on a Tuesday morning and watching fighting from Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And watching a guy like Inoue, the great bantamweight. Wow. For 118 pounds, I can't think of a more lethal puncher that I've ever seen.
If you have slow motion, and sometimes, in a fight, they'll show the knockout, then they'll show in slow motion. You can see how he gets the torque on his punches. I mean, but the torque in boxing is from transferring your weight from one foot to the other. That's where the torque comes. And hitting the guy the exact time you make that, easier said than done, you know. But boxing has got so many interesting things. The sport itself, the fighters, their managers, the promoters, the trainers, you know, all of them are sort of, you know, not normal people. So, no, it's fascinating and almost endless in, you know, material.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, hell, man, like you said, you've been writing boxing for 50 years now. And I mean, again, it's all the different colors of the sport come through. And certainly in your first book, Boxing Babylon, but no question, the current book, Hooking Off the Jab. Can't recommend it enough, man. Everyone's going to really enjoy it. Fantastic essays.
I've had 4 reviews, and they've always been, you know. But you know what I'm looking forward to? Don Stradley's going to review it in the next issue of Ringside Seat.
Hey, that's great, man. Outstanding. And,
yeah, I mean, yeah, he's so good. Don can write anything. He was a theater major.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He knows a lot about theater and movies, and he's also written stories for like art magazines. He knows fine art. That's why I've only actually seen him in the flesh twice in my life. Once at the Boxing Writers Banquet and one at the Hall of Fame when I was inducted. But you can talk to Don. He's a great person to talk to because you can talk about damn near anything and he knows it.
Well, he and I talked to Joe Palooka when he wrote that article.
Oh, that was good. Yeah,
in Ringside Seat. And yeah. I really, shame on me, I didn't talk to him about his Hagler book, but I should talk to him about his new crime book that he's got coming out.
Yeah, he's been, I think he's pretty much exhausted. He's been churning out those books. I mean, he had another boxing one. I forget what it was. But,
the one about Boston, about just the fight scene in Boston and everything, and a lot of the ham and eggers in Boston.
I think he had, I know he had War.
Right, the Hagler Hearns box.
Yeah, and there was one before that strictly about boxing, but I can't remember. But
yeah,
he was a great discovery for me. He's gone past me now. That's one thing you see when you get older, that your students surpass you, you know, and that's the way of life. But I'm glad some of mine are in that position. You know?
You taught him well, man. I'm telling you. And Bill Detloff's another great example. I'm looking forward to his Matthew Saad Muhammad book.
Oh, yeah.
Really, man, I'm glad that post ring that, and post ESPN, I should say, that you're still putting stuff at Ringside Seat and Boxing Weekly and, you know, Boxing News, I should say. So that's great, Nigel. I mean, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, besides being my only way I can make money, except bagging groceries or something, keeps me sharp. You know what I mean? Writers are like an athlete. If you don't do it all the time, you're going to lose it.
Well, you haven't lost a step, man. No, it's yeah. And really.
It just takes me longer. It takes me twice as long to write a story as it used to.
Honestly, it's writers like yourself and Bert and going back to the classic days of A.J. Liebling and W.C. Hines and people like that, boxing writers have always I've always appreciated them. And to even do my little BS stuff that I used to do in the Agate section of Boxing Illustrated, just covering.
That gives you a little piece of it.
Well, I certainly felt like a junior part of the club. So
before the internet, everybody read all those Agates of the Ring because slowly the newspapers were covering the big fights then, but some of the more remote ones and stuff like, I mean, we had correspondents all over the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Working for nothing.
Hey, Jack Obermeier, of course, the wonderful Jack Obermeier.
Yeah, I really miss Jack.
Great writer. Funny as hell.
That was really sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw him about 2 days before he died.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes with a more private venue, I want to tell you about the last time I saw him.
So, okay.
Well, I'm going to go out on a sad note, but Jack was one in a million, you know. I'll tell you one thing. He was dying. He knew he was dying, and he was the same guy, hard-ass, smart-ass. right up to the end. He didn't like sort of feel, he acted like, I remember I was there. He got a phone call. What did you call me for? Do you hear I'm dying or something? It was just, I'd be curled up in a ball sucking my thumb.
I hear you,
but,
man.
But Jack was, he was a tough guy, but he was a good guy. I really liked him. And Jeff, of course, Jeff Jowett, who's our close friend. A lot of my friends are dying at this age. That's one of the bad things about living to an old age, that a lot of people you know die.
No, well, I hope, I'm glad you're still around, and I'm glad you're still doing it, man, because, again, you're a great voice for boxing, and I'm glad to have appreciated your career and also getting to know you these last
couple of years. Yeah, I'd like to actually be physically together and have a beer or something and talk at some time.
Dude, everybody
out there that buys my book, I just want to thank you. If you don't like it, you're not getting your money back.
Hooking off the jab, everybody.
And, all right. Thanks a lot, man.
Absolutely. And if you haven't picked it up yet, Nigel will be in New York at the Trinity Gym on December 1st signing books. And I'm telling you, it is definitely worth your time. Lots of great stories. And I would imagine at the signing, Nigel will share some more stories.
Everybody wants to talk, you know, about boxing. And if they want to buy that book, they're going to want to talk about boxing.
Attaboy. Yeah. Well, as always, man, hey, if you want, stick around after we finish the bracket. Unless you got to go. I don't want to keep you if you got to go.
I got to eat.
All right, go eat. No problem. Everybody,
thanks a lot. This has been great, man. Thanks a lot. Thanks, always. Everybody that is in. Now, I can put this on so people can listen later.
The YouTube link is live. And mm-hmm. I will send you the audio link tomorrow, because I'll probably
okay, great, you on man. Tomorrow. All keep right, doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Nigel. Likewise, man. Great talking to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Nigel Collins, everybody. Thanks a lot for watching. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy, stay healthy.